Well, since we skipped last week, thanks to my not realizing I should call Larry, see if he could host. But I was actually quite sick with the flu, so in a way, it was probably a good thing I couldn't do it.
Glad you're better.
I am. I'm over it. It was good. We are in chapter 12 still. We are doing the details still. So, for those of you who are new, we decided some time ago, thanks to Mark's prodding, that we would first read a chapter and do an overview, kind of get the big picture. Then we would go through the details in detail. And then we would reread the chapter and get the big picture back. So we're doing that. And we have been in chapter 12. And I must confess, I don't remember. I'm hoping Floyd will remember where we left off.
Was that like 3 weeks ago or something?
Two
It
weeks
seems
ago.
like right.
How good's your
Well,
memory, Floyd?
actually, the last one I wasn't on here, and I haven't heard it because somebody didn't give it to me. So I'm a little
I
out
did
of
just
sync.
5 minutes ago, so I was thinking that we were I need Peggy, I think.
Verse 5 or 6 is where my brain
Mark, you were here last,
goes.
but you didn't stay the whole time, did you?
No, I think the last time I was on, I just started it and handed it off. So.
Floyd.
Okay, so I'm gonna, Brad, were you thinking the beginning of verse 5 or after?
Yeah, I was thinking beginning.
I think that sounds right to me. It seems to me 5 is the number. So
Okay.
That's where
let's
my
go
brain
with 5.
left off.
Well,
Doesn't mean it's true.
I remember 1260, but that could be from another week entirely because, well, it shows up. So I'm happy to start at 5.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
Well, if
true.
nobody remembers, it doesn't matter, right?
Exactly.
That's true.
Well,
Our listeners later might be going, oh, why don't they just listen?
It'll matter when Floyd listens to the recording.
Yeah,
He
that's true.
will know.
But we might come up with something totally fresh,
Oh yeah.
and they'll go, wow, that's why they read it again.
Yeah, might give Floyd more opportunity which one he wants in the recording. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I always have to stop and take more notes anyway every time I go through the recording, so.
Okay. I'm at, going to ask Bill to read verses 5 through 6.
5 and 6, okay. This is Revelation 12, verses 5 and 6 from the Free Bible Version. She gave birth to a son, a male child who will rule all nations with an iron rod. Her son was snatched up to God and his throne. The woman ran away into the desert where God had prepared a place for her so that she could be looked after for 1,260 days.
I remember we talked about the rod.
As I read it, I'm like, wait, I have read this before.
Well, what about the rod? Because that's a very fascinating detail. So
Well, we did talk about it at length.
except I wasn't here.
You were, because I
Oh,
remember you speaking up about
okay. That's been a
it.
long time.
So should I read The War in Heaven?
Yes, go ahead.
And how far down? Just the I have through the next paragraph is 7 through 9. Or do you want me to go
Yeah, go
into?
ahead, do 7 through 9.
Okay. There is war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. The dragon and his angels fought, but he was not strong enough, and they could no longer remain in heaven. The great dragon the ancient serpent called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world, was thrown down to earth, and his angels with him.
Somebody whose name I won't mention has written an article in an Adventist magazine, but not an official magazine, against belief in a cosmic conflict. And he claims that, you know, how we have traditionally in the Adventist church believed that the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 and the prince of Tyre in Ezekiel 28 represent Satan. He just says, oh, that's myth. So I'm going to be working on a paper. I don't have time to really work on it now, except I've been working on it in my head for the Adventist Society for Religious Studies meeting that's in San Antonio, November. I don't know what, but it's in November before Thanksgiving vacation. And I'm going to tackle that issue as well as other issues that I remember, and I can mention this name because he's passed away a long time ago. Fred Veltman, who used to teach at Pacific Union College.
He was my instructor.
Yeah. He wrote a long list of reasons why the Great Controversy view was not biblical.
Really?
And my roommate, I was no longer at PUC. I was home from Andrews, recuperating from mono. And my roommate sent me a copy of that paper. And I was really troubled. I'm telling you this background because in the process, I'll tell you how I resolved it. But I read it and I was like, it was because, you know, I don't remember if he said that the king of Babylon and the king of Tyre were myths. They are, actually. Sorry. but I'm going to deal with that in a minute. He outlined all the reasons why the Old Testament passages didn't cut it, and all that mythological terminology wasn't meaningful, or something or other. I don't remember exactly how that went, but I was very troubled by it. I was still in my early 20s. In fact, I was actually 22. And I remember thinking, oh, what do I do now? How do I answer this? Because I didn't have the education I have now and the skills that I have now. And suddenly a light bulb came on. I had taken a class from Dr. Doug Waterhouse at Andrews University in the undergraduate religion department. And he had just hammered away on Leviathan. Leviathan, this mythological creature that was Canaanite, but it was in the Bible, and it's a big important feature in the Bible, and he was so gung ho about Leviathan and all of the mythology, and I was just going, no, you can't do that to my Bible. So, a friend of mine came up to me who was in the class. One day, she was sitting with me in the cafeteria, and she said, "Jean, what do you think about what Dr. Waterhouse teaches about all this mythology?" And I said, "Oh, I think it's terrible." She said, "Well, will you go with me to Carl Kaufman, the chair of the department, and we'll tell him that he needs to fire him?" And so. I reluctantly agreed to go. I'm not a combat person, but unless I get into an argument about something, then I can be, unfortunately. But, I didn't really want to take on the good professor. And so, I reluctantly agreed to go, but I came down with a relapse of mono and I ended up going home instead. And God just let me stay home for about a year and a half. But and during that year and a half, I got this piece of paper from Fred Veltman, and suddenly the light bulb came on that Leviathan is supposed to be there. That mythology is helpful Actually, the Bible doesn't incorporate it as mythology. It incorporates it as with mythopoeic language. It uses the language of the myth, but not the myth itself. But this was the whoop and wharf of the ancient Near East, is this kind of languaging. And they knew what they were doing with it. They were talking about local wars of nations coming up against them and so on. And they would use this mythological language and tell the story in language that wouldn't get them in trouble with another country and would also satisfy their need for emotional healing. Mm-hmm. Now, but of course, the person who said that this is a myth and therefore doesn't have any relevance, what he didn't know is that there's more than one definition of myth. And really the first, I believe it's the first definition of myth, is a story that may or may not be true, but that explains why something happens or why something exists. Mm-hmm. But it can be true.
Mm-hmm.
The more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, this is part of the ancient Near Eastern perception. Can we not give the Bible an opportunity to speak to its own people at its own time and the concepts and the language and the storytelling that they are used to?
Sure. Makes sense. Jesus did it.
Absolutely. Well, if we're going to call, if we're going to say that the King of Tyre and the King of Babylon are myths, what about Jesus' parables?
Right. Especially Abraham and
the rich man and then Lazarus.
Lazarus.
You know, yeah. Lazarus. Yeah. Just like, whoa. Mm-hmm.
So,
Myth does not equal fiction, if I'm hearing you correct.
Correctly. It can. The third meaning or the second meaning is fiction. Yeah. And that's, of course, how he was using it, but that does not fit mythology.
Gene, wasn't it God that used Leviathan in the,
the book of Job?
In the book of Job.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I asked, after I came back to Andrews, I was a much humbler student. I wasn't so up in arms about what I was being taught. I was sitting in a Hebrew class with Dr. Waterhouse, and he was going on and on about Leviathan one night. That was really a trigger point for him. And I said to him, because he always used Isaiah 27:1 and some of the Psalms and all of that to talk about Leviathan. And I said to him, what about Job? What about Leviathan and Job? Because of all the places in the Old Testament, Leviathan figures the largest in Job. And he said, you know, I hadn't thought of that. And I went, what? I didn't say that out loud, actually. He said, I'll have to look into that. I remember that night thinking, if I do an Old Testament PhD, I'm going to do my dissertation on Job, on Leviathan.
Wow.
Well, I did a dissertation.
You did. You did.
That, I tell that because this is how important, and they'll dish, I've heard a professor at PUC that I team taught an honors class with, I mentioned Revelation as proof of a cosmic conflict, and he just, nah, that's just, imagery and all of that. Why is imagery bad? That's what I don't understand. I can almost hear Ellen White say, have you no imagination? She would say that when things like this came up.
I guess my question is, let me see if I can sort out my thinking. How we understand the Bible, the nature of inspiration, the nature of translation, yet it's narrative. It tells a collection of stories, and those stories seem to have threads. And we have the Council of Heaven in, or whatever it is, in Job. We have Revelation, a war broke out in heaven. We have Ezekiel and a few other that give hints and suggestions of something much larger than the interactions of Earth. So if you don't have that, what do you have and how does that influence the story?
Exactly. Well, my contention is the Bible is not a systematic theology. And the people that say these things seem to think it has to have systematic theology to be right.
How do you define systematic theology, Gene?
Systematic theology is a treatment of theology that's very, very Greek, static. You set it down as mostly apologetic, meaning that you're trying to defend the faith. And you set it out and you define everything and you laboriously go through and state what it is. And
very formulaic.
Very formulaic, a very absolute.
Provable.
Yeah.
Whereas so much of the Bible is story.
The Bible is not systematic theology. If you want to know what a systematic theology is not, the Bible is it. Yeah. And that's the way God inspired it. He didn't inspire it to be set and cement in some kind of colossal form.
Mm-hmm. He used story and all of us messy people to tell that story.
Story and poetry.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is another the opposite of left brain.
Yes. Yeah.
Another thing is that when Jesus talked, many times he said things in a way that could be understood more than one way. Mm-hmm. It wasn't absolute. There was nothing absolute about the way he said things.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I found that out in Job when I translated the entire book. There are sentences in Hebrew that can be worded in opposite meanings. I have a whole list of them. I give them to my students, and I don't know if they quite understand what I'm doing or not, but they're ambiguous. They can mean the opposite of what they're taken to mean. For example, Job says when his wife counters him and tells him to curse God and die, he says, does God do only good and not evil? That's how it's translated. The problem is there's no question mark in the Hebrew. And this is not poetry, where a question mark isn't so necessary. And Edwin Good of Stanford University points out, it could be just as easily, God does good and not evil.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And that's a very crucial line. I mean, if depending on how you translate it, you could be on one side or the other of the book. And that's what I came to the conclusion that these ambiguous statements are there on purpose because the author is trying to create two sides, the side of reward and punishment and the side of God's cosmological justice. And those ambiguous statements, you're going to translate them according to which side you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Mark has his hand up.
Sorry, Mark.
You kind of made my point already.
I'm sorry.
But to put a, well, no, that's fine. That's where you were going. So, but to put a finer point on it, it's very difficult for somebody who is looking for authority and seeing the Bible as a literal guide to, you know, deeds to be done and sins to be shunned, to say, you know, I have to interpret there. So imagery, the mythology as a story that gives meaning, it's very difficult for those people. And, you know, I don't want to get sucked into it, but I also want to give them as much grace as possible to say, you know, they're doing the best they can.
Well, it has occurred to me that they I don't know what they did in English classes, but literature must not have been an important matter to them.
Mm-hmm.
And interpretation.
I'll be the devil's advocate on that one, if you will, that I think we can compartmentalize fairly easily, whether we should or not. We can have poetry, we can have all this, but when it comes to religion or theology,
yeah,
we can compartmentalize.
It's supposed to be different for religion and theology.
That's the way it seems to get treated when it becomes a systematized rather than narrative, embracing the richness of the challenge. Anyway, that I don't know if that, I can't speak for anybody. I can just see that as a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right, Bill. And I don't know. And I don't want to get into this because I'm not the judge, but I, you know, we all have our biases.
Yeah.
And some things that control biblical interpretation a lot is pure skepticism and an unwillingness. I shouldn't maybe talk too much about my paper, but I want to end with, well, first I want to go through and do an apologetic of the cosmic conflict. Mm-hmm. And then I want to point out that if we're going to view the cosmic conflict as a power struggle between God and Satan, we're better off without it. And then I want to show by a comparison of Enuma Elish and Marduk, the Babylonian god, the patron god of Babylon, and Yahweh in Job and in other places. I want to show the difference between a power struggle god, which is Marduk to the core, and a non-power struggle god, which is Yahweh to the core.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well done. Nice.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Can I have a copy when you're done?
Sure.
My conclusion from the last few years in Revelation is very much along that line. I guess I word it a little differently, that the war is over what kind of power or what defines power. Mm-hmm. So the war is not like we think of war, because when we fight wars on earth, it's guns against guns. It's violence against violence, and the strongest wins or the most strategic wins.
Or skilled.
Right. But this war goes beyond that, because this war says, it's a war over what methods should be used. Mm-hmm. It's a war over what motives are most important. This is a war over how to fight war. That's what I'm seeing. And the lamb who willingly lays down his life and is slaughtered by his enemies is declared the winner. It's like, wait, that's not how you define war. Well, that's totally, the whole argument. Is
totally counterintuitive.
Yes.
So
everything about it.
That does, in our reading, war in heaven, so that immediately our biases and assumptions about what war is. Mm-hmm. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought,
so
but he was not strong enough.
This week.
We have, Gene, we have the language here of a power struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So I know we have talked around this a lot through our studies. What sits here to help guide me beyond?
It's the end point. Go down to where we haven't read yet. Now, this is the center point of the book of Revelation, or the part of Revelation that is all
central.
One part. Chapters, I think it's chapter... chapter 4 through 21-22. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, verse 10, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. The accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them day and night before our God, has been thrown down, They gained the victory over him on account of the blood of the Lamb. That's the victory. That's so now won the war.
We have to go back and wrestle with the life and testimony of Jesus and what that means.
Yes.
Okay. I'm okay with that. I just, you know, it's a tie-in. I just want to...
And the word war itself is all about words. It's not about physical altercation.
Bingo. I was just about to jump in, Floyd, when you're talking about the definition of war. Seems to me this is assault, an assault on the meaning of the word love and truth. Those are exactly what Jesus came to show us they look like.
So when we say no, they could no longer remain in heaven, strong enough to prevail in this context would be had no supporting evidence, just accusation. And that the loyalists, if you will, were just like, please talk to the hand. We're done with you. We need to see this play out, and God's made a way to see it play out.
And I've wondered, in addition to words, because you can use words as in force, as a weapon of force. But I've wondered if in addition to words, there wasn't some action, and that this was the action. So I go to Jacob's night of wrestling. He's in the dark, praying for deliverance from his brother Esau, who's coming with 400 men. And suddenly, in the traditional telling of the story, a man grabs him or seizes him. That is false. In the Hebrew, the verb is a man intertwines with him. There's no word in Hebrew for hug. That would be the closest I think we could come to a hug. So what if God embraces Jacob, and all he can think in that night in his terror of Esau is that now I'm had. Mm-hmm. He sees it as a half Nelson instead of as an embrace. And he begins to struggle to get out of that embrace. And he struggles, and there's this wrestling match until finally the being touches him. The word is touch. It isn't strike. It isn't hit him on the thigh. He touches him on the thigh and dislocates it. And he knows anybody that could dislocate his thigh with a touch has to be divine. Mm-hmm.
And could have won this battle a long time earlier.
Yeah. And it dawns on him.
This is God.
This is God, and God could have killed me.
Yeah.
With a touch.
Yeah.
He must have forgiven me. He can't be like Esau. Okay, I'm going to give a little correction on something I said last week. That wasn't quite factually correct. I mentioned a word in the Jacob Night of Wrestling story that is usually translated wrestle. And I suggested that it actually can mean the intertwining of something. And I'm not going to discount that. I'm just going to tell you a more nuanced statement. I looked it up just to make sure, because I had this faint memory that I had decided maybe it wasn't accurate. And then I looked it up, though, and it's interesting because this word is only listed with this reference. So it's probably used only once in the Hebrew Bible. And when it's used only once, you have to kind of guess at the meaning. And because they couldn't imagine a divine being or otherwise grabbing or getting a hold of Jacob without seizing him and arm wrestling him and so on. There's another related word that's closely related, I think, because it's in Jewish Aramaic from Babylonia. And in Jewish Aramaic in Babylonia, it actually can mean to embrace. Mm. It can mean to intertwine. It can mean, yeah, the other meanings, but it can mean to embrace. So I don't think I'm that far off.
So are you saying that that word didn't mean that, or?
No, I'm saying that it's guesswork that it means wrestle. And it's an educated guess because to most translators, well, of course it was wrestling. What else could it be?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because no being would give him an embrace. I mean, they just wouldn't go that route. So the meaning of the word, because used only once, we have no other context to compare it with. And so it's really a guess that it means to wrestle. But in Jewish Aramaic, which is very closely related to Hebrew, it means to, it can mean to embrace. Mm. So I'm thinking that the word means to embrace there.
God gave him a hug.
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't, it meant that he intertwined around him here. He, whatever. But that would be embrace, really.
I wonder if his name, Heel Grabber, influenced some of the previous translations of Grabber.
It is. That is pretty bona fide.
You know, the idea that Jacob was wrestling in his mind could be very true.
Oh, yes. I'm sure the wrestling began as soon as the hug.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sure Jacob didn't say, "Who is this hugging me?" Right. He was like, "Oh, no, I have an enemy on me." Yeah.
Definitely was his mindset. I'm in danger, danger. You know, this is not a safe place.
Now, if you were out in the wilds and you knew that your brother was on foot with 400 men acting as soldiers, anybody touching you would just be somebody you had an adversarial relationship with. By the way, the word face is central to the story. It's what's called a light fort or a leading word. It's used over and over again. I believe it's to tell the story of the two faces, the face of Esau, who Jacob last saw as frowning in fury. And Jacob has to flee for his life. And when he gets to Laban's area, he has to go through a time where he learns humility and how to treat his brother. So when he comes back, he tells his brother, "I am your servant, Jacob. You are my lord, Esau." He's making a subservient treaty with him. But what he has to struggle with that night is God like Esau? Because we are affected in our growing up years by everybody around us, everybody that's close to us. They become our picture of God to a great extent. That's what Jacob had to wrestle with. Who is God? What is he like? And he comes to believe that he forgave him and that he is not like Esau, that he is love.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I interpret that story. So translate this to the war in heaven. If God came to give an embrace to Satan, he's now in rebellion. A person in rebellion who has developed hate hates love. Because love makes them feel weak. And so I see the possibility of the war in heaven being God trying to show his love to them and they can't take it and they leave.
Exactly. Or truth.
And truth. Yeah. I see those two as going together.
Yeah.
And what's the Greek word for the word war? Because I think I've heard someone say it's polemos, or a word that that, you know, is all about words. It's about ideas, the war of ideas, instead of a physical force kind of war that we as humans think of.
I forget what the war meant, war is in heaven. I don't think the word you used is it, but I may be wrong. I'm looking it up here.
It's very close.
Testament. What? Polemos?
Polemic? Yeah. Polemic, I think.
Polemos, I think, yeah. Is...
I don't know how to pronounce it. It's all Greek to me.
It's more than
Polemos. So let me look it up, because I do know how to spell it. I have this humongous dictionary that I consider to be the best dictionary. There is, I have a lexicon as well, but the lexicon is a bit biased.
Helen's had her hand up for about 10 minutes.
Oh, Mark, go ahead, because it'll take me a while to look this up.
I think he said somebody else. Am I the only one with a hand up?
You, Floyd, and I think Helen had.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say that I really appreciated the point about the Hebrew and there not being a question mark, and the fact that we can come down on either side of something depending on how we view God. And, you know, this, but it creates issues with, you know, when you're trying to talk to people at church about things like this, the traditional interpretation is so often trotted out. And, you know, it's very hard to talk to someone about a different version of God when they interpret, talk about the cosmic conflict and war in heaven and how God dealt with it and so forth in terms of a holy justice, a righteous justice. And it's okay because God's doing it. And so they kind of excuse it by saying that, well, you know, God is God, and in order to keep peace and so forth, this was what he needed to do. And, yes, it broke his heart and made him sad and all those things. And I just can't find a way to get through to people about the fact that you can't make God bipolar. You can't, you can't say, oh, yeah, it's okay when God does that stuff, but it's not okay for people to do stuff. So I love the fact that it's possible, from all the things you've been saying, to reframe the concept of what war really means and what power really is, into something that is in keeping with what we now understand about the character of God. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
Well said.
Well, I would like to be the contrarian here. So I'm going to hedge this about with a whole bunch of caveats. I grew up very militaristic, as in I had two brothers who flew attack aircraft in the Navy, etc. We argued about this stuff back and forth. I have since become about 98% a pacifist. But there's that other 2% that requires me to be the contrarian here. The other caveats I want to put in is I believe God always, always acts from the highest sense of love and freedom in all situations.
Amen.
That's right. But
that being said, I have to leave room in my thinking for the use of force, particularly in the defense of innocence and the maintenance of freedom, and not necessarily be counter to the highest sense of love. And, yeah, I just want to throw that out there, that I know we often, we're combating a place where we've got militaristic nationalism coupled with Christianity. I think that's an abomination and blasphemous, but it doesn't have to eliminate the proper use of force. So
let me put it in Bill speak. What I hear you saying is God can set boundaries, and abusers will tell you those boundaries are forcing them and their behavior.
I would agree with that, but I would take it farther than that. Okay. I would suggest that if it was the highest act of love, God would actively destroy somebody. And I think of that particularly at the end of Sin and Sinners. Now, I believe that the nature of reality is such that him just letting him alone is instant death. But just to illustrate the principle, if God could diminish suffering in the universe by taking a life without violating love or freedom, I think he would be duty-bound to do it. There's nothing inherently wrong with violence. It all depends on the context, the outcome, and the motive.
Interesting. Well, I think, Bill, I want to get back to where we're going with this, because our sermon today in church used Exodus 34, verse 6 and 7. And it says, if you don't mind, from Free Bible Version, the Lord passed in front of him, Moses, calling out, Yahweh, Yahweh, I am the God of grace and mercy. I am slow to become angry, full of trustworthy love, and always faithful. I go on showing my trustworthy love to thousands, forgiving guilt, rebellion, and sin. But I will definitely not clear the wicked. There you go, Mark. The impact of sin will affect not only the parents, but also their children and grandchildren up to the third and fourth generation. Now, was that God? Was that the impact of sin?
Just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that use of force as punishment or retribution is at all justified. Right, and I'm about to lose battery, so if I disappear, that's what happened.
Okay. Yeah, no. And because the reason I bring that verse up, some translations use the word God punishes. And that doesn't fit most. And it's only Free Bible that talks about it's only Free Bible that says that the impact of sin will affect the parents.
The literal word means visiting the iniquity upon.
Yes, thank you. There we go. Okay, so it's not God enforced or inflicted. And if it was about force.
And even if the language said that, the language is language. And that's where I have to realize, it's like what I was telling my students this last week. Mm-hmm. We were in my Kings and Conquest class, we were talking about how Saul killed himself. And I took them over to First Chronicles 10. And it tells how Saul put himself on his sword, impaled himself, and killed himself. And then his armor bearer killed himself because he didn't want to be culpable. And several lines down, verse 13 says, thus the Lord slew Saul.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Language. It's a language issue. I would like to just say one thing, that I don't think God would use force if there was any other way the situation could be resolved.
Jesus agrees with you.
And I would wholeheartedly agree with that as well.
And I see that there are other ways of it resolving. I also see that sin at some point has to be shown for what it is.
Exactly.
And then it has to come to its full fruition, its full maturity, and it has to show its full consequences. And that is painful. Exactly. But how is the universe going to be safe if we don't see that action? Polemos does mean war, battle, fight. I can't find anywhere in this dictionary, which is a very comprehensive dictionary. It's classical Greek. It's all eras of Greek and words and their meanings. I can't find anywhere where it talks about words. We use the word polemic to mean words. But that's an English, I don't want to say perversion, but it's an English way of dealing with polemos. It's not the Greek way. So I think we have to take the whole Bible into account when we look at a text like Revelation 12. And that's one of the reasons why the dragon is symbolic here. It's so that we will think less about war, but more about who is this dragon and what is he trying to do? And the best description of him is in Job. I would like to go to Job.
I wanted to just comment on where you were almost finished going. You talked about God giving Lucifer a hug.
Mm-hmm.
And I think previously at other times you've talked about the way that the angels fought back was the same way. You know, against their...
No, I don't see Satan's angels fighting.
No, I was saying.
Oh, you mean the angels? Yes.
Yeah. It says Michael and his angels fought, and
yeah.
Satan and his angels fought. So, and they fought differently. Again, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. the method of fighting is what the war is over. And it reminded me of something that I just had a discussion about this a couple of weeks ago. My brother-in-law is living with us now and my sister. And, when I was much younger, I think I was probably about 12 or something along there.
Yeah. I think you've told us, but go ahead.
We went to visit him in Florida, and my dad did something that made me so angry. I was just out of control. And my brother-in-law is very, very different and is very nonviolent and mm-hmm. maybe trying to rescue me from certain severe punishment from my dad. And so he just picked me up. The Lord gave me a hug from the backside and picked me up so that I was helpless. Like, you know, I was off the ground. I was out of control. I was screaming and crying and literally having a huge tantrum. And he was trying a different method besides my dad was about to probably whip the daylights out of me. And I was so out of control and there was nothing I could move except my legs. And I began kicking his shins with all my might. And I kicked his shins black and blue. I mean, it was vicious. And I consciously knew what I was doing, but I was out of control. You know, I mean, I was so angry. And yet I really cared for him, but I was so angry that that's just what I did. Well, that made a very deep impression on him, but it also made a very deep impression on me. And we were just talking about that a week or two ago, and he brought it up and we shared both sides of that. And he said, you know, that just made no sense to me. He couldn't understand why I was kicking him because he wasn't doing anything to me except trying to help me. Mm-hmm. But yet that actually fits perfectly what Jacob was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob was fighting a hug.
Mm-hmm.
And God was refusing to let go of hugging him
mm-hmm.
because that's what he'd been longing for his entire life. And he came to hug him and he's going to hug him. And Jacob is just kicking and screaming all night long. And I know what that feels like.
I also just wanted to mention the EG quote that comes to mind that God could have killed Satan, eliminated Satan as easily as one could cast a pebble to the earth, but he did not, you know, because you go, okay, destroy Satan and man, you take care of a lot of death and murder and horrible, terrible, all the terrible, awful things that happened would have been eliminated, but it would have violated the principles of love and freedom. And so God took a huge risk and allowing Satan to share his distorted perspective on God that God knew would result in terrible agony and suffering and pain and loss. But, you know, God knew that that ultimately would be worth the risk, because that's how God operates. He always operates in love. He doesn't destroy. I don't see God as destroying. I see God giving us up and letting us go. And there are times in the Great Controversy story where he definitely intervened to save and preserve the line of Messiah. But anyway, I often thought, why didn't he just go, oh, that's, as he's thinking of his creative design, oh, yep, that's not going to work out in the end. And he just could have not created Lucifer, but he created Lucifer knowing full well how Lucifer would act and rebel and get all of us in a terrible mess.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Leviathan in Job. I had that open. I want to read Job 41. Well, let me start with 38. Who enclosed the sea? The Hebrew word is yam, and it's the same as the yam, who was the sea in Canaanite language, but was a god. Yam was a god. It was a god of chaos and evil and what we call combat myth. Who enclosed the sea, or yam, behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and dense clouds its wrap, when I imposed my limit for it and put a bar in doors and said, you may come this far and no farther, and hear your proud waves be stop. If you think about Job chapters 1 and 2, God sets a boundary to Satan. Mm-hmm. He is in your hand, but you may not touch the man himself. Everything he has is in your hand, but don't touch him yourself. Mm-hmm. And then Satan comes back for more in chapter 2. And he is told, God tells him, all right, he is in your hand. He says, let me have the man himself, skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. So God says, okay, he's in your hand. Only guard his life. Don't kill him.
That's so telling.
And so let's go to chapter 41. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Restrain his tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through his nose, pierce his jaw with a barb? Will he beg you at length? I'm going to change translation. This translation does not translate this way I do, but NRSV does. I'm sorry about that. I just realized I picked the wrong translation for this. Okay. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will it make many supplications to you? Will it speak soft words to you? Will it make a covenant with you to be taken as your servant forever? Will you play with it as a bird, or will you put it on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over it? Will they divide it up among merchants? Can you fill its skin with harpoons, or its head with fishing spears? Lay hands on it. Think of the battle. You will not do it again. Any hope of capturing it will be disappointed. Were not even the gods overwhelmed at the sight of it? This is Enuma Elish reflection here. When the gods hear that Tiamat, who's the parallel of Leviathan, she is the sea. And she is the chaos monster of evil. When they hear that she's coming up against them, they become overwhelmed with terror. And they don't know what to do. No one is so fierce as to dare to stir it up. Who can stand before it? Who can confront it and be safe? Under the whole heaven, who? It is like God is asking for someone to take on Leviathan. But he goes on. I will not keep silence concerning its limbs, or its mighty strength, or its splendid frame. Who can strip off its outer garment? Who can penetrate its double coat of mail? Who can open the doors of its face, where there is terror all around its teeth? Its back is made of shields and rows, shut up so closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined to one another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. Its sneezes flash forth light, and its eyes are like the eyelids of dawn. From its mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fires leap out. Out of its nostrils come smoke, as from boiling pot and a burning and burning rushes. It breath kindles coals, and a flame comes out of its mouth. In its neck abides strength, and terror dances before it. The folds of its flesh cling together. It is firmly cast and movable. Its heart is as hard as stone, as hard as the lower millstone. When it raises itself up, the gods are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches it, it does not avail, nor does the spear, the dart, or the javelin. It counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrows cannot make it flee. Slingstones for it are turned to chaff. Clubs are counted as chaff. It laughs at the rattle of javelins. Its underparts are sharp potsherds. It spreads itself like a threshing sledge on the mire. It makes the deep boil like a pot, and it makes the sea like a pot of ointment. It leaves a shining wake behind it. One would think the deep to be white-haired. And now he comes to his conclusion. On earth, it has no equal. A creature without fear. It surveys everything that is lofty. It is king over all that are proud. This is a beast that cannot be conquered by any human method.
You know, it just occurred to me that this resonates really strong with the scroll that could not be opened and nobody could be found. I'd good never connected that before.
Good connection, yeah. Floyd.
Yeah, because on earth is no one who is his equal. It takes someone above, and it takes God himself. And the way he does it is become a human being,
which is the Lamb, because even the one on the throne could not open the
scroll. That's true. It was the Lamb. Well, the Lamb is God.
Right. But the part of God on the throne appeared to be stymied and unable, and it was unable without the part of God who is willing to go to the very heart of the beast and meet it at its headquarters.
Yes.
And wow, that you've nailed something. This is interesting to me because this creature is without fear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who is without fear? Because perfect love casts out all fear. Well, where did Satan grow up? Well, who did he know was so loving that he could manipulate his character and not be afraid of God, use God's character against him, and start a war about him because he knew he wasn't going to get destroyed because he knew the heart of God.
That's interesting. I never thought of that before.
Yeah.
Thank you.
He knew God better than anybody, and he wasn't afraid of being punished because he knows God's not in the punishing business.
You got it.
Yet he portrays God as being punished, so he makes everybody else afraid.
Mm-hmm. It would seem to indicate he doesn't understand, at least from my perspective, God is life. And the absence of God is a ceasing of life. And so therefore does insinuate that if he were to lose his life, it has to be as a punishment from God. It would seem to me that there's a disconnect in understanding, oh, I won't get punished. And yet there's an understanding that to cease life would have to be an imposed penalty.
Or is that what he implies?
That's what he implies.
So he doesn't think he'll ever die.
I think he did not believe he would ever die until the cross.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. And I don't think he knew the nature of sin or the nature of his opposite rebellion of God. Because that's my definition of sin.
Because I'm going to let you know some of my cogitations here that probably some people would raise eyebrows at. So I'll test it out on you. You have to follow my thinking. The king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 is not named.
Mm-hmm.
Sennacherib is named mm-hmm. in Isaiah. All other kings are named in Isaiah. Who is this king of Babylon that's not named?
And which scripture again was that from?
Isaiah 14. If you go to a book by Tolkvist, that's Gotrapithia, it's all the epithets of the gods that they had. And you go to Marduk. One of Marduk's epithets was Shar Babylim, king of Babylon.
Hmm.
I believe that Isaiah had in mind that the king of Babylon was Marduk. If you go to Deuteronomy, the gods are demons.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that Marduk, that the demons created gods in the imaginations of the people of the ancient world to be themselves. So every evil angel had a god that represented them, and Satan had a god representing him.
Mm.
And he probably had more than one god because he had to deal with all the nations. So Baal, Melkart of Tyre, the king of, who probably was styled as the king of Tyre, also figures, I think, in Ezekiel 28.
Mm-hmm.
As Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Satan wanted to improve on the government of God. Why? Because he did not believe it was possible to love.
I think that's the one thing that Satan didn't know about God, because it seems at the cross he was shocked that God would go to that extreme to take on the punishment. I mean, that is a part of love that he didn't understand, I don't think.
If you put these pieces together, the battle is over love. And it is over an exhibition of love, because when Jesus is hanging from the cross, he's embracing the whole world.
The whole universe.
I wanted to share this Leviathan piece with you, because what is being said here is actually a play off of Tiamat. In Enuma Elish, it's been rewritten to include that. The original, you might have noticed, Leviathan seems a lot like a crocodile. That was the original writing of it, I believe. But I believe that after the exile, or during the exile, somebody revisited this and contemporized it. God seems to be looking for someone to take on Leviathan. But he makes it very clear that none of our weapons can deal with him. Only someone who is God can do that. And in the Bible, we lose that. In Revelation, we lose that. He's the Lamb. As you said, Floyd, you don't have to interpret the Lamb as God in Revelation. You could ignore that. But that's what it turns out.
And I believe that when we were just talking about, did Satan believe that he would die? It's right here in this passage. I believe Satan believed that he was immune, and even his angels, well, just because of how they were created. And it's, you know, none of them have ever died yet.
Right.
And when he tempted Eve and he said, you will not surely die, there had never been death of anything anywhere in the universe. Right. So all the evidence was in his favor. And right after the cross, which is in this chapter, you know, he later on, it says suddenly he's very angry because he knows his time is short. This is after the cross. And he realizes for the first time in his existence that if he loses credibility with everyone, he has nobody to leech life out of anymore, and he could end up ceasing to exist because he's nothing but a leech. He's a parasite. He has to get life like a pyramid scheme. He has to suck it out of others. And when nobody is willing to give it to him anymore, he has no source left. And he realizes that because he's been exposed and discredited at the cross. And that makes him extremely angry. And now he wants to take as many with him as he can.
The Bible says that God only has immortality. How do the angels have life?
Well, God gives life to every creature.
That's what I thought.
He gives life to Satan.
And they have to receive it and get it some way. And I think Satan and his angels get it vicariously through us. When we give Satan authority, we're actually extending his life.
Yeah, so to follow on from what you're saying, Floyd, Satan, in effect, he becomes irrelevant because he loses his audience, he loses his purpose, and so he becomes irrelevant because no one's, you know, at the end of all of this, when sin is shown for what it is and people make their choice, well, he becomes irrelevant because he loses any influence that he can have when it's all done.
And I think that's what's described in chapter 20 and why it specifically mentions that Satan all by himself goes into the lake of fire. Mm-hmm. It's that loss of credibility with everybody. And that's the lake of fire for him.
Yeah. Well, that fire, if you use Ellen White's perception of that in Signs of the Times, that fire is emotional agony.
Yes. And the way he's hidden from that is through credibility with those he deceives. And when he marches on the city and then he's exposed as the fraud that he is, and there's not a single being anywhere in the universe that will give him the time of day anymore, what can he do? He can't deceive anybody more because everybody's been undeceived and they can't undeceive their undeception. He's stuck.
Well, isn't it possible that his own angels turn against him?
I think everybody turns against him. His own angels, all his followers. That doesn't mean that they're not in the same position. They come in the next lake of fire. But I just think it's interesting that it specifies that he goes into the lake of fire, and then it identifies the lake of fire as the same place where the beast and the false prophet have gone. Mm-hmm. Well, they have their lake of fire previously, and I believe it's the exact same thing. They lost credibility. They were exposed as a massive fraud, and they lose all credibility, and therefore they go into the non-existence. And then the next lake of fire, Satan is fully exposed. Now he goes into non-existence or lack of resources. And after those two are out of the way, there's no more excuses. Everybody else now has to deal with themselves. And that's the final judgment judgment is light. It's not about God condemning. It's the light exposes everything and the natural consequences of being exposed, and your character and how you react to the light becomes your destiny. You either love the light, you thrive in it, and you continue to receive life forever, or you hate it and you choose death, and there's nobody else to give you life anymore because you can't manipulate anybody else. That's how I see the end of evil. And that's why it has to be fully exposed. Mm-hmm. And that's why I still believe God never resorts to violence at any time for any reason. He doesn't need to. Evil will do it. Evil will create its own violence. In the illustration of Jehoshaphat, you know, that was the one of the times when people actually decided to let God do it his way. And God said, you don't need to fight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But God didn't destroy them either. Mm-hmm. It's very clear in the story. God did not destroy their enemies. He could have. He's said to have done it many times. But when they completely trusted him to do it his way and they praised him, which is a new song, that is how the enemy is defeated, with the new song. That's the weapon that the loyal angels use. That's the weapon that we have to use. That's the weapon that the seven angels who pour out the plagues, they're pouring out praise to God. We're already told what's in those censers, what's in those bowls. It's prayers and praises. That's what's in the bowls. It's the incense. And that's what destroys evil. You can call it violent, but praising God is a nonviolent mm-hmm. aggression, if you want to call it that. And I believe God is going to be completely vindicated in the end and saying, no, I never had to use violence against my enemies. They will destroy themselves. They're allergic to love and they will choose death. And God never has to impose death on anyone. Even though he's been attributed with doing that, and we are so conditioned to believe that it has to resort to violence or God cannot win. That's part of the deception of Satan that still lingers. And God has to be exonerated even from that. That's just how I've come to believe it, because I was taught my whole life growing up, well, God runs out of patience and that's God, you know, he's got the right to do it. And after a while, you know, all the torturing people in hell and burning them and killing them because, well, they sin and that's what they deserve and God has to do it. It's a strange act, but, you know, he's got to do it. I was taught that my whole life, but it never fit. I could not reconcile that with love. I just couldn't. And when I began seeing this, and it took years for God to convince me of this, it's like, oh, okay. Love is not a conglomerate word that you can put anything into just because God does it. Love is love, and it's love is God, and God is never, ever, ever inconsistent with the principle of giving and giving and giving, even if it causes his own death. And he's going to be consistent with that character all the way through to the end. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to resort to the method of the enemy. He just doesn't have to. And that's the hardest thing for us to believe.
That's so well said, Floyd. Absolutely. I think that is what we're supposed to get in Revelation. And I think of the verse that said, he that has the Son half life. He that does not have the Son does not have light. And John 3:19 through 21 also talk about the difference between those who love the darkness rather than light. They don't want to come into it versus those who do what is true. They come into the light. You know, it's all a personal choice, and that decides our destiny, not a punishment, not destruction from God.
I was going to add this, the strange act. At no time, it seems like in the narrative and in the universe, has God let go other than his Son.
Yeah.
And so
that's the strange act.
Yeah. The strange act is letting go, not implementing a death penalty.
Right.
I mean, you know, I guess both are available to choose, but why not choose the, you know, he lets go. I don't know.
The one that looks like Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is what Revelation is supposed to teach us, this upside down kingdom, which is so different from our power over beastly influenced view of how you deal with a problem. And God's view is love and is very different in terms of letting each person decide their own destiny. It is not something he has to do to them. Sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death, not at the hands of an angry God.
And even this revelation, this rod of iron, which sure looks like an instrument of force. If you look up that word, he will rule with a rod of iron. That word rule is literally translated shepherd.
Mm-hmm. Shepherd's rod, right?
Well, the word means to shepherd. So, mm-hmm. Well, how do you shepherd? Do you beat the sheep into submission? Well, some people do. But that's not how Jesus describes shepherding.
They know my voice.
Yeah.
Jean's got her hand up.
Trying to regain control of her own class.
No, I just want a voice. I'm not good at butting in. I am actually badly bad about that, but I'm trying not to be. I have a confession to make. I used to believe, as Graham Maxwell taught for many years, that God did destroy people in the flood, Sodom, Gomorrah, and what have you.
Emergency
measures. I used all the terms. Emergency measures, rotten food in the barrel, or one rotten apple in the barrel, and on. And my students, the millennials, did not buy it. They would just look at me like, And so I won't tell you the story of how I came to believe otherwise, but basically I came to believe, well, it was based on Great Controversy, pages 35 and 36, where she makes it very clear that the judgments of God are not God's actions. And she uses that word judgment for everything, the flood and Sodom and Gomorrah and all those Old Testament stories. So that's what changed my mind. It changed me too. At least it started to. I think I still have some work to do. And the area it changed me in is how I treat cats. This is going to sound kind of strange, but I used to be called the Cat Lady of Angwin because I fed 7 outdoor cats. But I found out I would get really mad at a cat that would steal another cat's food. And I would yell at that cat, and all the cats would run away. I realized, oops, I can't do that. And after I realized that God never uses violence, he's not a violent God, it changed the way I treated those little creatures. And it changed the way I started treating people. Not that I was violent per se, but I became more gentle in my speech. And I honestly think that if we don't get clear in our minds, mm-hmm. that God is completely non-violent, that we have that residue of ability to be violent ourselves, because as the father goes the son or the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we are really, really close to a return to the Middle Ages.
I agree.
I think we are very close. And I think we're going to be shocked at where it starts. That's all I want to say.
You're not going to tell me what you mean by Middle Ages?
Middle Ages. The
Dark.
Dark Ages.
Dark Ages, right? Okay.
The Dark Ages. I thought you were.
The feudal system, the extreme hierarchy, the polarized super wealthy, super poor, absolute control, very rigid justice.
Well, I was thinking actually of probably not the Middle Ages, but the choice of burning people at the stake.
Oh, yeah. Intimidation.
Yeah.
Torture.
Yeah.
Killing.
In the name of God.
in the name of God. Yes. I think we're very close to that. Yes,
I agree. To that.
That's scary. But when you brought up Graham, I thought of another thing he used to teach us. And that is that, you know, God is not willing that any of us should perish, of course, and that he wouldn't ask of his creatures something that he himself had not done. And so when his character is called into question, sin won't kill you. He comes and demonstrates it himself. He doesn't ask us to. And then he puts to rest his case and says, you decide. And that verse is 2 Corinthians 5:21. It says, God made Jesus, who never personally sinned, experience the consequence of sin so that we could have a character that is good and right, just as God is good and right.
That's great. Is that the free version, free Bible version?
Yes.
That's a restoration to mirroring the correct image of God.
Mm-hmm. It's about healing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can no penalties.
So you can understand how critical it is to get the good news and the truth about who God really is, and that he's not a God that resorts to violence, coercion, force, power over, which is such a different view than so many churches preach in order to prepare us to emulate how he acts. Because anyway, you can just see how, or we just revert to this power over coercive, crazy deterioration.
That's what's going to happen. What's going to happen on our planet. And yeah, only God can save us from it. And he will,
yes,
as long as he has work for us to do.
You know, this resonates with something that just happened to me a couple weeks ago. I was raised on force. I would be whipped for doing wrong things with the premise that I'd get enough fear of whippings that I would stop doing it. However, it didn't work. It just made me more and more angry and bitter and hating both my dad and God subconsciously. But I couldn't express it, of course, because that would get another whipping. And if God whips you, who knows how bad that's going to be. But I could never love God. It was absolutely out of possibility for me. Well, I began slowly learning that probably God wasn't like that, and probably this isn't a very good way of raising kids. But because I had never seen anything else modeled, I did not know how to raise my kids differently. I just knew it wasn't good. I knew it didn't work for me. But when push came to shove, I had to do it to them because that's the only thing I knew to do to stop their bad behavior. So I didn't do it near as much as my dad did, but I didn't know what else to do. And I caused similar damage in them. They don't want much to do with God or anything else. And I take the blame for that, but it's God's problem now. And I've been praying for them, and particularly my son. And I don't know if I've shared here, but I've told the story many times of how God's used me praying for my dad for 2 years and God responding by saying, I'll do that, but you have to go first. And so for 2 years, he began exposing in me a lot of anger and shame and bitterness and all kinds of stuff that was slowly starting to get unearthed. And near the end of that 2 years, and I went to a counselor, and he shared with me the amazing truth in Matthew 18 about the true nature of forgiveness. And then I went and had this out of body experience with my dad, literally, where my dad was in a bed in the nursing home. I was sitting at the chair at the end, and I had this strange sensation that I could read his mind, which is scary because I really didn't want to be like him. And yet I knew exactly what he was thinking. And I'm sitting there inside thinking, having this dialogue and talking to God about what I'm feeling or whatever. And suddenly I wasn't in the chair. I was in the bed instead of him. And in the chair was my son. And then God said to me, until you deal with this chasm between you and your dad, I cannot answer your prayers for your son. And then I was back in the chair and I was just like shocked, because I had been trying very hard during that time to figure out how to reconcile with my dad, and I had no idea how to do it or what to say or anything. And yet God says, you have to do it. So the next morning I came back in by myself, determined that whatever it takes, I got to reconcile this. I got to deal with this. All this rage and anger and bitterness toward my dad that I had had for 40 years, I had to deal with it. And I didn't know what to do, but I was determined to do it. And I'm like, God, I'm willing to do it. You're going to have to tell me what to do. And so I came in, and now I'm feeling at a loss, and I'm fidgeting around, and I'm making small talk, and I'm trying to figure out. And I was getting frustrated, and I'd been there before. And finally, I'm like, God, you got to tell me the words to say. I'm clueless. I'm willing to do it. I just don't know what to say. And he said, remember what I just taught you 2 weeks ago about Matthew 18. I'm like, oh, I got it. Thank you. And I went over to my dad and I said, Dad, I need to talk to you. I said, when I was young, you hurt me really bad. You abused me. You caused me a lot of pain that I still carry around. But I learned something recently. And I said, I want you to know that I don't hold any of that against you. I take full responsibility for all the pain that you caused me. I'm not holding it against you. And my dad just started bawling. And from that day until when he died a couple years later, our relationship was absolutely, totally opposite. And I didn't even know it until like the next day when I came in and suddenly, spontaneously wanted to hug and kiss him, which is the exact opposite of how I'd felt toward him my whole life.
Wow.
And until the day he died, we were, and he could receive it. It was just gone. It was gone. Well, 2 weeks ago, we had a family reunion. And you guys knew it was coming up because I couldn't make it here. And I've been praying for a long time that God would be there on every single person. There was plenty of potential for conflict. And I was just praying, and I was using the new song kind of prayer. Like, I'm thanking God, I'm praising God ahead of time, whatever he's going to do. And I'm just absolutely using the weapon of the new song like he's been teaching me. And I got there and I'm just like, just going to watch and see what God does. I'm not going to try my own agenda or anything. I'm just going to see what God does. Well, I came into the living room downstairs, and our family was all staying there in my sister-in-law's house. So we were in one room. My daughter and her husband were in another room. My son and his wife and stepson were in another room. And so we were sort of, you know, the downstairs was sort of for us. And I came into the living room and I heard my son's wife talking to him, trying to reason with him about the way he was treating her son. Well, I've observed for years, he treats his son a little bit too much like I treated him. And it really hurts me when I see that. He's got good intentions. He's got a wonderful heart. He's got an amazing wife. But when he's trying to improve, and his stepson is, I don't know, 9 years old now, I think. And he's a great kid. But the way my son is trying to help him, his tone of voice, his demeanor, it's got that feel of force. And I know he doesn't want to do that. And I know exactly where he got it. it resonates. That's exactly what I did to him, and worse. And now his wife is trying to get him to see that. And I just stood there and I realized this is my time.
Yeah.
And so I just butted in and I began telling her how my son feels when she talks to him that way. I wasn't shaming her. I was just trying to explain because I know how he's feeling. I can read his mind just like I could read my dad's mind. And then I took ownership and I said, I know how he's feeling and I know what he's doing and why he does this because he got it from me. And I feel so bad about that. And I apologize. And his son was looking at me in just amazement. And my son started crying.
Mm.
And I just kept confessing. And then I went over and I sat down and put my arm around. And we cried together.
Wow.
And then I said, I need to tell you a story. And I told him the story of my dad and how I'd started praying for him when it was impossible. And I dared God to do the absolutely impossible because my dad was hopeless. There was no way he could be saved. He was so stubborn. He was so hateful and spiteful and mean-spirited, you know, on the inside and so fanatical. I couldn't see any hope. But I said, God, you specialize in the impossible. So I dare you to save my dad. And that's when God came back instantly. He said, sure, I'll do that. You first.
Yeah.
And then I had to argue with God. What do you mean me first? He's the one that's got the problems. No, you first. And so for the next 2 years, I'm like, okay, me first. But the very first thing God said, I said, okay, what does that mean? What does that look like? What do you mean, me first? What do you want me to do? He said, well, for starters, you remember that book that I had you read years ago called Unconditional Love? And I'm like, oh man, that was wild. I never heard of such a thing. I was so excited about that. I sent it to my dad. My dad says, oh, that's a heresy that's coming into the church. He says, you remember that? I said, man, I can never forget it. And God says, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to love your dad unconditionally with no hope that he'll ever change.
Wow.
I said, okay, excuse me, God, but I'm not being impertinent, but you've lost your mind. You're crazy. You know I can't do that better than I. What are you asking me to do? That's impossible. No answer. Finally, it's like, okay, I get it. It's true. I can't do that. So you're going to have to do it through me, aren't you? And he says, oh, you're catching on.
Yeah.
So 2 years later, after a whole bunch of ministries from various sources, I was able to go to my dad and forgive him unconditionally. I finally learned what that looked like and look what it did to him. Now I'm telling this story to my son and I'm telling him what happened in that room. And I'm telling my son, it was me in that bed. You were sitting in the chair, but the same chasm that I had with my dad was with you. And I told him what God said to me. And, you know, and he's just, he can't help it. He's just melting. He's crying. And I'm going, God, what are you doing? This is amazing. You finally answered my prayer. Now, it's not over. It's just starting. But you know what? God can now work with my son. And I was finally able to share with him the story that involves him in this generational crisis. And it's up to God to finish it. But I tell you what, I'll never forget that weekend. And I'm just eagerly waiting to see how God's going to continue the story. So this, everything we're talking about here is really resonating and bringing this up for me.
Yeah. Hallelujah, Brother Floyd.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
I think we're all have been close to tears at some point during your story. It's very moving.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful, a beautiful parable or illustration of what God is trying to, what he taught you, Floyd, which is what he's trying to teach through this story. It's all about loving and letting go of the anger and the hate when you're wronged and bad things happen. So it's a beautiful portrayal. That's what God's response is, to love us in that crazy, unconditional way. And that's the only thing that brings healing and transformation.
I was just thrilled that I could see emotion spontaneously come out of my son because, you know, I know how I feel. He's hardened against God. He wants nothing to do with. And I said, I know that. I understand that. I don't fault him for that. I gave him that horrible picture of God. But guess what? That's not God.
No.
It was the enemy's plan.
Yeah. So now he's at least caught. And my daughter, who is very angry and bitter about that picture of God that she, not just that I did to her, but other people did. And she joined a group on Facebook who are former Adventists who are all very angry and bitter about their conservative parents and all that kind of stuff. So she can resonate with that. And she came over and gave me a hug because she is moved that I'm reconciling with my son. So God's working on her too. Mm-hmm. And hey, it's all in God's hands. God's doing all of it. All I want to do is know how to cooperate. And God keeps telling me, you first. You first. Not just with your dad, but with your kids too. Take ownership.
Well
Take
done.
Responsibility.
So the way I see this, Floyd, is it's not just because your dad doesn't have any ownership. It's because you are willing. It's because God can use you.
And I talked to the counselor who gave me Matthew 18, a radical new way of looking at it. I talked to him later, and he said, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the first time in your dad's life he had ever experienced forgiveness and love, ever.
Right.
And I stopped, and I know my dad's history. He had a terrible life growing up, much worse than mine. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. Mm-hmm. He didn't know what forgiveness was. He didn't know what unconditional love. That's why he was suspicious of it. He never experienced it. How could he do it? He never had it.
Exactly. You can't give what you didn't get.
That's right. And I don't hold it against him. I'm thrilled that he was able to get free before he died.
We can only love to the extent that we have been loved.
That's right. And we were able to love each other for the last 2 years, even though he was very limited in his capacity. And that was just amazing. And that's what I want with my kids. That's what I want with everybody, really. One step at a time.
That's incredibly brave, Floyd, what you did. And I can only think that you've probably begun the process of turning around all of that stuff. And I can resonate with some of that stuff. But, yeah, that's a really, really brave thing you did. I mean, I know I have apologized to our daughters for what I've maybe done in giving them a negative picture of God. And it's made a difference with them too. It's really opened them up to having more conversations about God again. Not that they were anti, but it just wasn't something that we really talked about or was really relevant in their lives. But I worried terribly that I hadn't given them a good enough picture of God growing up. So very brave, very brave, Floyd.
And your bravery in sharing that story with us, that touched me really deeply. And I appreciate your vulnerability in sharing that. And it's just, like I said, spot on for all of us in our journey of that choice to forgive when we don't know if we're going to get anything back. That's kind of the point. I don't know if this is going to benefit me, but I'm going to forgive and let go of and love in spite of the pain that I've experienced. That's what God does. Mm-hmm. And it is, you're right. It's the new song.
God showed me a number of years ago that vulnerability, willing vulnerability, is the very atmosphere of heaven.
Yes, willing.
That's why I cannot believe that God ever resorts to violence, because violence is anti-vulnerability. The lamb demonstrates the truth about God, which is vulnerability to the point of death. He refuses to stop being vulnerable, and we hate that because we don't want to be vulnerable, because we're going to get hurt and we're going to be exploited. Yes, you will. Jesus said that. You know, if you follow me, you are going to have trouble, because the world is exploitive. But vulnerability, if we want to live in the atmosphere of heaven, we got to follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And that means willing vulnerability. But it makes sense, because without vulnerability, it's impossible to have intimacy, and we were created for intimacy.
A spoiler alert for the next session we do, Revelation 12:11, they didn't love their lives so much that they were willing to die if necessary.
Yes.
I think, to me, puts the exclamation point on the vulnerability and following the Lamb and conquering through the blood. But, you know, I don't want to open that can of worms, given,
our time is pretty much up.
It is. I wanted to say one last thing to Floyd. Floyd, I had no idea when I brought up Exodus 34 about visiting third and fourth generations that you were going to tell this story. Nor in any way do I want to make you feel like guilty or anything for bringing that up. But
no, it's a fact. It's just a fact. It's a generational reality that we have to deal with.
And I wanted to applaud you for letting the legacy of that verse fail to come true in your family. Thank you.
Yeah.
It stops with you.
It stops here. Well done. We can reverse that.
Well, it went back about three or four generations, so it's time for it to stop.
Yep. Thank you. Yep. I agree.
But you know, any person in any generation can break the cycle.
Yes. Exactly.
If you look at the Ten Commandments.
Yes.
The Ten Commandments, showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Anyone can break that cycle.
That's right.
And that passage in Exodus, which I believe, and I misapplied for most of my life, where it says, but in no way clears the guilty, which most of my life, that just negated everything he just said. Mm-hmm. Oh, that gives God a loophole to punish people. And then I went back and I said, okay, I got to reconcile this with my Jesus looking God. And that doesn't fit. What does that actually mean? And it struck me, God is not saying, oh, there's an exception, I'm going to punish some people. What he's saying is, my forgiveness, my unconditional forgiveness, does not suspend the law of natural cause and effect.
Exactly.
There will be consequences, but they're not coming from me.
No. There's nothing in that.
We have to separate.
There's nothing in that text that says God does it. It just is.
We read it into it.
Yes, I know we do.
It's the nature of sin, the impact of sin.
Well, I think we've come up for air. But thank you, Floyd, for your testimony that makes this time together very special.
They overcome him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. This is how I overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Let's pray. Gracious Father, thank you for what you have done in so many lives who have accepted the picture of God that you gave us through your Son, through the Lamb. Thank you for what you did for Floyd, for his father, and now for his son, and for his daughter. We believe that you will finish the good work you have begun. So we look forward to the sequel to this story. But we pray for all of us and everyone who has the beautiful message that you have given us to bear about yourself. That we will not just see you as you are, but that we will be like you. Transform us through the power of your Spirit, the power of love.
Amen.
And make us more like you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Thank you, all of you. What a blessing.
Amen.